recorded live.
Coincidence and fate figure largely in our lives.
All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts.
This is like some radical Alice in Wonderland. That's what this is.
No one intervened on behalf
of... I think stuff is both real and not real at the same time.
Real, unreal, what's the difference?
I have no idea where this will lead us, but I have a definite feeling it will be a place both wonderful and strange.
Anyone who isn't dead or from another plane of existence would do well to cover their ears right about now.
Hello, world. I'm Violator of the Stygian Port, filling in for Will and Doug here at the 42 Minutes Podcast. This is my first All Violator podcast. No guests, despite some tempting offers. I decided to do it myself for about 40 minutes.
Do you like to do it yourself?
Sometimes. I mean, if the mood strikes.
Is it too much for me to sample 40-year-old virgin when talking about talking for 40-some-odd minutes? Interestingly, I didn't realize it when I originally decided to use the clip, but it actually leads nicely into my next topic. It is said that one can only begin the study of the Kabbalah at age 40, which really means that when you understand that numbers such as 40 have symbolic meanings, in this case a period of purification and preparing for something, such as being born after 40 weeks of pregnancy, then you are ready to tackle the deeper wisdom of the various religious texts, or in my case, the wisdom found in movies and TV shows.
When's your birthday?
January 30th.
Interesting.
Why?
We met on September 30th.
Yeah?
Well, a lot of people tell you there's no meaning to dates and numbers, but I'll tell you something. They're wrong. And it has nothing to do with astrology, which is like total bullshit. What's your sign? I'm a Gemini. No, no, no. It has to do with the dates and numbers themselves.
Why?
Because they mean something.
What's the meaning?
It takes time to figure out. But it's there. And it matters. Kind of like in the Kabbalah. Only not the Madonna kind. Trust me. Dates and numbers have to be right.
Okay.
It is, of course, highly subjective. I believe it's Avi in the film Waking Life who states that movies are a record of the ever-changing face of God, which to me says that cinema reflects the ever-changing inner reality which is solidified on film and occasionally projected outward for others to interpret for themselves. I think this is from Wikipedia, and it reads, Kabbalah is a set of esoteric teachings meant to explain the relationship between an unchanging, eternal, and mysterious Ein Sof, no end, and the mortal and finite universe, his creation. So the infinite-slash-creator and the finite-slash-created. In Montauk Revisited Adventures in Synchronicity, Peter Moon writes that Crowley is also on record for stating that space is finite yet boundless. Stephen Hawking also believes that the universe is boundless yet finite in size. The Urantia book, a purportedly channeled work obtained in a similar fashion as the work of the sleeping mystic Edgar Cayce, states that the immensity of the total material creation we know at any given moment in time is limited, although to your finite minds it is comparatively limitless, virtually boundless.
We are infinite beings, or are we finite beings? Which are we? Which are you?
This double truth of the universe, or of our perception of the universe, is what I'm going to try to introduce to you here. The idea that things can be both true and untrue at the same time. Niels Bohr, one of the founding fathers of quantum mechanics, stated that The opposite of a correct statement is a false statement, but the opposite of a profound truth may well be another profound truth. From Wikipedia, he conceived the principle of complementarity, that items could be separately analyzed as having contradictory properties, like behaving as a wave or a stream of particles. The notion of complementarity dominated his thinking on both science and philosophy. One of my catchphrases is that the center of everything you believe is a lie. Literally, if you spell out the word believe, B-E-L-I-E-V-E, the center of it is the word lie. Truth must be couched in fiction, like the yin-yang symbol where the light half contains the seed of the dark half and vice versa. Things cannot be completely one way or the other. They seem to always come mixed together.
And a lie, Mr. Mulder, is most convincingly hidden between two truths.
This fact of nature should be obvious to anyone who keeps abreast of world events, the news, pretty much any kind of debate between two sides of whatever story. Might just be my American upbringing that makes me or allows me to see this duality, but whatever it is, it's part of my reality tunnel and has led to many interesting avenues of thought. I recently completed a collaborative book project with my Project PsyCube allies, Frank Zero and Trevor Toko, among others. And the idea that truth and fiction are a package set couldn't be more obvious than in the case of ufology. Terence McKenna had his close encounter, which he details in True Hallucinations, when he was in La Chirera and witnessed a rolling mist turn into four discs and then, as it flew over his head, into the thoroughly debunked image of a UFO photographed by George Adamski, which was actually the underside of an old Hoover vacuum cleaner, I think. It is typical of this type of phenomenon to introduce itself cloaked in a veil of unbelievability. We might have an epiphany while watching a movie, as if it was our own thought, when it was really just a kernel of truth hidden in the fiction. A wholly subjective truth, important only to that person at that time. A spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down, so to speak. It's dependent on the state of mind of the observer, for when the student is ready, master appears, which is to say that when you are ready to learn something, it'll be presented to you in a way that you probably don't expect it, because it's subjective and your mind, aka the universe, works through a type of synchronous fate. There's a greater impact when knowledge is gained through epiphany and through solving the riddle for ourselves, rather than reading it in a textbook or having it spelled out for you by some other medium. Interestingly, only the court jester, who was a clown, could speak the truth to the king. If you haven't already seen the movie John Dies at the End, I'd tell you to pause this and go watch it, but you might forget to come back, so just forget everything you heard here afterwards and then see the movie. So John Dies at the End begins with the main character, David Wong, who's a white guy that changed his last name, so it'd be hard to find, doing an interview with a guy named Arnie. So he tells Arnie that his mom used to be a crank-addicted cannibal vampire. And Arnie's like, is that true? And David's like, well, no, she was just bipolar, which kind of was a dualistic idea there. And then Arnie says, well, I thought you wanted to get the truth out. Like, why are you telling me lies? So it's interesting that the movie begins with a bit of, you know, sort of fiction for its truth, although it's obviously quite fictional. But even David Wong seems to be trying to present true information couched in fiction. So the events of the movie are kind of initiated by a mysterious alien black oil that confers upon those who ingest it psychic powers. Although, if they kind of squander their powers and they're not a good medium for the black oil, then they'll just randomly explode. Which was something that happened in a movie I just saw, Visioneers, where people are exploding from stress. So anyways, before going on, I need to mention Terence McKenna's drug-induced vision of a parallel or alter Earth. So hopefully I get the story right. So basically there's this wave whose frequency is the size of the universe. Like one wave reaches across the whole universe. And this thing happens once in the lifetime of a universe. McKenna calls it, a soliton wave of improbability. And what happens is that when this wave interacts with matter, it creates double in that instant. So when it hit Earth, it was at some important point in the life of Jesus, maybe the resurrection. but it only happens in one universe and not the other. So in Alter Earth, Jesus, for whatever reason, isn't larger than life. And to borrow a word from Jordan Maxwell, consequently, there's no Catholic Roman Empire. And consequently, there's no Dark Ages with its suppression of science. Interestingly, on philipkdick.com, there's a brief synopsis for alternate world novel The Acts of Paul, which is an unpublished book where Paul of Tarsus doesn't have his conversion experience, and consequently, this causes an alternate world to branch off from ours. Long story short, technology advanced much quicker in McKenna's Alter Earth than it did here, and they came up with a theory of splitting the atom, but never in practice, because their calculations showed that a nuclear explosion might affect parallel worlds. They tested this theory in northern Siberia, the Tunguska event, and then they became concerned with our ability to destroy their world with our nuclear weapons. Yada yada, someday we'll merge with them, or they'll bring us over, there'll be a new Jerusalem, a new heaven on earth, or however you want to end the mythological story here. It's obviously not a true cosmology. Anyone who does mushrooms or any kind of psychedelic like that might come up with a million different cosmologies for the universe. None of them are true, but they're all unique, fascinating, and usually some sort of similar concept going on in them. So John dies at the end, which has the awkward acronym JDate, the Jewish dating website. Just thought I'd mention that. So in the movie, David Wong and his friend John travel to a parallel world where they're greeted by the high priest, I guess, of a religion that's based around them. Sort of like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, where they're kind of revered by future humans. And speaking of Bill and Ted, when they die, they go to hell and they face a drill sergeant who runs a military school that their dad was going to send them to. And he says, "Gentlemen, welcome to hell." And in J-Date, the high priest or whatever says, "Gentlemen, welcome," a couple of times. But he doesn't say where he's welcoming them to, whether it's hell or maybe it's heaven. If our world is a spiritual hell, then maybe Alter Earth is like a heaven. Maybe every potential universe actually has two parallel realities that go along with it. Maybe everything comes in twos. So this priest guy explains to David and John that they are in an alternate universe and that they have been trying to communicate with our world, already sounding similar to McKenna's description of his Alter Earth. And the priest continues saying that our universes are twins, dual offspring born of the same litter. Now starting to sound a lot like Philip K. Dick's exegesis. At the end of Valis, PKD states that one mind there is, but under it two principles contend. And in his two-source cosmogony, he writes, "The one was and was not, combined and desired to separate the was not from the was. So it generated a diploid sac, which it contains, like an eggshell, a pair of twins, each in androgyny, spinning in opposite directions, the yin and yang of Taoism with the one as the Tao." And Philip says that things will basically correct themselves when the healthy twin undergoes a mitosis, splits into two, and the kingdom of God arrives. The machinery for this transformation, the procession within time from the age of iron to the age of gold, is at work now. In eternity, it's already accomplished. And then, speaking of twins, actually, there's a character that's like a pop psychic Yuri Geller type, and he has two identical twin female assistants or bodyguards or whatever. They're kind of like the Isis and Nephthys to his Osiris, perhaps. Going on from the idea of twin universes, this priest guy explains to John and Dave that there was a man born in both worlds named Cyrus Rooney, and in our world he died at the age of 17 while trying to crossbreed a bull with a Clydesdale. But in their world he lived and continued his work of bestiology, which led to technical advancements and an accelerated timeline compared to ours. This is, again, similar to Terence McKenna's idea of an Alter Earth, which wasn't stunted by the Dark Ages. When Cyrus Rooney died, his greatest invention, Korok, became self-aware. This Cthulhu-like Korok needs both John and Dave to join with him so that he can absorb their ability to travel between worlds and to maintain himself while under the influence of the black oil without randomly exploding. so that he could cross over to our world and, I guess, assimilate everyone. Departing from my usual territory of movie discussions, I have a cousin who was playing Bioshock Infinite on his Xbox, and the little bit I saw of it was pretty intriguing, and I'm going to destroy that story for you, so more spoilers. So anyways, Bioshock Infinite was put out by 2K Games, which is owned by Take-Two, which uses the T2 logo, which reminds me of Terminator 2, which brings to mind the Terminator line, which divides night and day. Isis and Neftis represent dusk and dawn. They're sort of the veil between night and day, and day and night. There are two gates between this world and the next, the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn, what used to be the summer and winter solstice. Aleister Crowley said that the only way out is through, so you can't go back out through the same door you came in. That'd be like trying to crawl back into your mom's, well, you know. Bioshock Infinite takes place mostly on the floating city of Columbia, which is suspended in part by quantum levitation and plenty of balloons. Not only is this America a lot more steampunk, but there's an alternate Earth in it as well, and as you can probably guess, the difference between the two worlds is the fate of one man. So basically this guy named Booker is distraught over some war crimes I guess he had committed in the past, and he has a life-changing moment when he's baptized, which kind of already sounds like Philip K. Dick's unpublished book or the plot of John Dies at the End. So he takes the name Comstock after his baptism, and he apparently supports the research of a Rosalind Lutice who's figured out how to create portals between worlds through experiments in quantum mechanics. The portal technology makes him sterile, I guess jumping through portals or time travel or whatever. But he wants a daughter, so Rosalind helps Comstock steal the daughter of Booker. That's right, he steals his own daughter from a parallel world where he didn't get baptized and change his name and do portal jumping where he became sterile. So during the portal jumping baby napping of Booker's daughter Anna, who Comstock renames Elizabeth, Anna loses the tip of her pinky finger, which puts her body and maybe even her soul technically in two worlds at once. This gives her the ability to open portals at will without any technology. Rosalind discovered during her experiments in quantum entanglement that she is actually a man named Robert in this other world. She communicates with her male half through the experiment until eventually they're able to open the portals. So Comstock eventually decides to kill Rosalind and Robert by rigging one of their machines, but the resulting explosion puts Rosalind and Robert in sort of a state of flux throughout space-time where they can appear when and wherever they want. Initially, they appear like twins who indirectly aid your character throughout the game and help him get his daughter back and fix the timeline. I don't know if this is from Wikipedia, but when Rosalind Lutice described her discovery, she said, "I have trapped the atom in midair. Colleagues called my Lutice field quantum levitation, but in fact, it was nothing of the sort. Magicians levitate. My atom simply failed to fall. If an atom could be suspended indefinitely, well, why not an apple? If an apple, why not a city?" So anyways, Bioshock Infinite was developed under the codename Icarus. Icarus, of course, was the guy who flew too close to the sun on wings made of feathers and wax. The wings warmed up and came apart and he fell into the sea and drowned. Icarus's dad was the master craftsman Daedalus, which kind of hints at a creator god or demiurge, like Jesus, whose dad is described as a tecton, which is a Greek word for stonemason or craftsman, but somehow translated as carpenter. Daedalus also created the labyrinth in Crete, which kind of represents the world and the path of life. Icarus flying too close to the sun reminds me of Plato's allegory of the cave, where the sun represents sort of an absolute unfiltered truth. He ended up drowning in the sea, which is the same fate of Narcissus, who fell into his own reflection in the mundane world, kind of like the chaotic waters of pre-creation. So Rosalind says of her quantum levitation that it's not actually levitation, it's just that her atom simply failed to fall. So she might actually be saying that Adam simply failed to fall from grace. She also says, like, well, if one atom could be suspended, why not an apple or run out a whole city? So that apple might be the apple in the tree, and again, the symbolism being that the apple is in a constant state of flux, just like Rosalind and her double, Robert. They're in a perpetual fall from grace. So early in the game, your character meets the Lutice twins, who hand you a coin and ask you to flip it and choose heads or tails. You flip it and it comes up heads. And Robert says to Rosalind, "Told you so," and then you notice he's wearing a sandwich board chalkboard and it has check marks for all the heads and all the tails, but there's no check marks for tails. It's been all heads for maybe 100 flips. So this kind of suggests that Bioshock Infinite is actually an infinite time loop. Interestingly, the plot to 1993's time loop movie 1201 sounds a little familiar to some news in recent years from CERN, where they thought they had discovered a faster-than-light particle. So in the movie 1201, they have a particle accelerator, and they think they discovered a faster-than-light particle that supposedly proves Einstein wrong, and that's what causes that time loop to happen. But the weird thing about it is you would never know if you were actually in a time loop, since you would wake up feeling like it's a new day and that tomorrow must be different, never realizing that our idea of what tomorrow is going to bring is really based on today, and today's repeating itself, and tomorrow never gets here. This kind of brings to mind Philip K. Dick and his various time loop theories, the Black Iron Prison, and that we're stuck in a sort of artificial time loop put together by some ancient alchemists.
It's okay. The subject of this speech is a topic which has been discovered recently and which may not exist at all. I may be talking about something that does not exist. Therefore, I'm free to say everything or nothing. I, in my stories and novels, often write about counterfeit worlds, semi-real worlds, as well as deranged private worlds, inhabited often by just one person, while meantime the other characters either remain in their own worlds throughout or are somehow drawn into one of the peculiar ones. This theme occurs in the corpus of my 27 years of writing. At no time did I have a theoretical or conscious explanation for my preoccupation with these pluriform pseudo-worlds, but now I think I understand. What I was sensing was the manifold of partially actualized realities lying tangent to what evidently is the most actualized one, the one which the majority of us, by consensus gentium, agree on. Later that day, back home again, but still deeply under the influence of the sodium pentothal, I had a short, acute flash of recovered memory. Then, in mid-March, a month later, the total body of memories, intact and entire, began to return. You are free to believe me or to disbelieve, but please take my word on it that I am not joking. This is very serious, a matter of importance. At that time, I had no idea what I was seeing. It resembled nothing that I had ever heard described. It resembled plasmic energy. It had colors. It moved fast. It collected and then dispersed. But what it was, what he was, I am not sure even now. In other words, it's a common theme in my writing that a dark-haired girl shows up at the door of the protagonist and tells him that his world is delusional, that there's something false about it. Well, this did finally happen to me. I even knew that her hair would be black. I had an actual complete sense of what she would look like and what she would say. She did appear. She was a total stranger, and she did inform me of this fact, that some of my fictional works were in a literal sense true. I wrote out these dreams in novel after novel, story after story. To name two in which this prior ugly present obtained most clearly, I cite The Man in the High Castle and my 1974 novel about the U.S. as a police state called Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said. I'm going to be very candid with you. I wrote both novels based on fragmentary residual memories of such a horrid slave state world. People claim to remember past lives. I claim to remember a different, very different present life. I know of no one who has ever made this claim before, but I rather suspect that my experience is not unique. What perhaps is unique is the fact that I am willing to talk about it. We are living in a computer-programmed reality, and the only clue we have to it is when some variable is changed.
and some alteration in our reality occurs, we would have the overwhelming impression that we were reliving the present, deja vu, perhaps in precisely the same way, hearing the same words, saying the same words. I submit that these impressions are valid and significant. And I will even say this, such an impression is a clue that at some past time point, a variable was changed, reprogrammed as it were, and that because of this, an alternative world branched off.
The Lutice twins say in one part of the game that the only difference between past and present is semantics. Live, lived, will live, died, dies, will die. And that it's all a matter of perspective.
No.
Dead is dead, Elizabeth.
Dead is dead.
What? The hell did...
I see heads.
And I see tails.
It's all a matter of perspective.
Why are you following us? Who sent you? Comstock? What do you want?
What do you see here? From this angle.
Dead.
Listen.
And that angle?
Alive.
Rosalind and Robert Lutice mention a few things that kind of speak to the dualistic nature of the finite yet infinite universe. They mention constants and variables, people being dead or alive. There's a point in the game where you have to choose which pendant to buy Elizabeth, either one of a bird or one of a cage. So there's some in-game symbolism there, but I'm more reminded of the optical illusion seen in the movie Sleepy Hollow, where Johnny Depp has this piece of paper with a picture of a cage on one side and a picture of a bird on the other, and has strings on it, and as he tugs on the strings, the picture flips around and it looks like the bird and the cage overlap, or that the bird is in the cage. And the bird-cage illusion kind of makes me think of the universe pulsing on and off, and you have hell and then whatever the other option is. So maybe that sort of alternating on and off makes it seem like we're trapped in hell when really we aren't. The story of the Lutice twins in Bioshock Infinite, obviously my favorite aspect of the story, kind of reminds me of an article I recently read on the Ayahuasca blog, talking about the movie A Serious Man. And so in that movie, Larry is more successful than his brother Arthur. He has a wife, two children, a career, a solid social identity. Larry is very intelligent, a professor of physics, and spends his time lecturing the laws and theorems calculated by people even smarter than he, yet remains the epitome of those who can do, those who can't teach. Larry is shown lecturing on the Schrodinger's cat thought experiment, and it's a good reflection of Larry's life. Larry's both teacher and student, married and alone, faithful and faithless, found and lost. It all depends on the observer. And that was all a quote, by the way, I forgot to mention. So like the Lutice, quote-unquote, twins said,
it's all a matter of perspective.
So Larry seems to be in a state of flux, the sort of perpetual fall of Adam. So quoting from IMDb's plot summary, though seeking for meaning and answers, he seems to stay stalled. So just like the Rosalind Lutice said, the atom simply failed to fall. Larry also has a sort of quantumly entangled twin, his brother Arthur, who might not have the social achievements of Larry, but Arthur has seemingly tapped into some sort of source of pure information that only his brother and physics teacher Larry could ever hope to understand. They sort of complete each other. The movie also begins with a scene from a totally different era where a man and woman are apparently haunted by a Dybbuk, which is sort of a Jewish idea of a ghost of a recently deceased person, in this case a rabbi. So again, like Schrodinger's cat, is he deceased? Is there information about his previous death correct or incorrect? Is he dead or alive, human or Dybbuk? And at the end, does the woman kill him or does he end up living? Part of this theme, I think, is the idea of the brother who dies and the brother who lives. It might be related to the constellation Gemini and the two stars Castor and Pollux. In the movie Face Off, actor and centuries-old vampire Nicolas Cage plays a criminal named Castor Troy who has a brother named Pollux. So in this theory, the one who dies tends to be considered the favorite, maybe because he's less tainted by a material incarnation. Like in the story Walk the Line, which is a true story, which is weird because it fits this, the favorite son is the one who's killed in the wood chipper accident early on. and the movie's Eagle Eye and Avatar, the identical twin who's considered to be the better of the two, was the one who's died at some point before the movie begins. The Hall of Maat in the Egyptian afterlife is also called the Hall of Two Truths. Each soul had to approach the Hall of Two Truths and have their heart weighed by Osiris on the scale of Maat. The heart was weighed against a feather, and if it was too heavy, it was consumed, but if it was too light, I don't think anyone ever said what would happen. Maybe being too light is just as bad as being too heavy. Not enough life experience, like someone who died too young. But if the scales are evenly weighed, as they appear in most, if not all, depictions of the scene, the person has made it successfully through life and death. They are now light as a feather, stiff as a board. That is, they're dead and stiff, but their heart is, according to the scales, as light as a feather. Before I finish this up, I need to pause for a little station identification. You're listening to the 42 Minutes Podcast, which is part of the SyncBook radio program, which also includes the Always Record podcast, as well as the new audio zine Synchronize. If you haven't done so yet, go to thesyncbook.com, where there's links to all the shows and a lot of off-show interviews, plus links to buy books of the SyncBook Press, including, in a month or so, hopefully, the latest collaborative work I've recently finished, which was on the topic of alien contact. You can find my work at thestygianport.blogspot.com. Although I pretty much took 2012 off, I've managed to update the blog at least once a month this year so far. But this month's update was just a link to a torrent with my most of my videos, including the DVD version of Here is Wisdom and the long-lost stinkhole videos that I made for the short-lived blog which lampooned popular synchromysticism. And now back to your regularly scheduled programming. This is from Jacques Vallée's Passport to Mangonia. It's the story of Fascius Cardan and the Seven Sylphs, as told by his son, or his grandson, maybe. So, in August 13th, 1491, when I had completed the customary rites at about the 20th hour of the day, seven men duly appeared to me, clothed in silken garments resembling Greek togas and wearing, as it were, shining shoes. The taller of them, who was of ruddy complexion, was attended by two companions, and the second, who was fairer and shorter stature, by three. Thus in all there were seven. When asked who they were, they said that they were men composed, as it were, of air, and subject to birth and death. It was true that their lives were much longer than ours, and might even reach into 300 years' duration. So according to Fascius Cardan's son, the sylph stayed with his father for about 3 hours, and they pretty much always told the same story. They always told the truth. But when he questioned them as the cause of the universe, they were not agreed. The tallest of them had denied that God had made the world from eternity. On the contrary, the other added that God had created it from moment to moment, so that should he desist for an instant, the world would perish. Be this fact or fable, so it stands. So this interesting story of the seven sylphs and the two of them that were slightly different reminds me of the scene of Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, where the monks are chanting or telling the story of creation in fear that if they ever stopped, the creation itself would cease to exist. And of course, the devil comes in and he makes them all stop talking, and the world keeps going, and it kind of destroys their worldview. But Parnassus says, well, someone somewhere is telling a story, and that act alone is enough to keep the universe going. Just kind of like the theme of the never-ending story, that the world of imagination land continues to exist as long as people continue to tell stories or continue to use their imaginative, creative process. So the universe may be both finite and boundless, existing for eternity and yet at the same time being created and destroyed from moment to moment.
Someone has been changing my marks. What a horrible place this is! It's not fair!
That's right! It's not fair! But that's only half of it!
This was a dead end a minute ago.
No, that's the dead end behind you!
It keeps changing. What am I supposed to do?
Well, the only way out of here is to try one of these doors.
One of them leads to the castle at the center of the labyrinth, and the other one leads to...
Bum-bum-bum-bum.
Certain death.
Ooh. Which one is which?
We can't tell you.
Why not?
We don't know.
But they do.
Oh, then I'll ask them.
No, you can't ask us. You can only ask one of us. Mm-hmm. It's in the rules. And I should warn you that one of us always tells the truth and one of us always lies. That's a rule, too. He always lies.
I do not. I tell the truth.
Oh, what a lie.
Oh. He's the liar.
All right. Answer yes or no. Huh? Would he tell me that this door leads to the castle?
Yes.
Then the other door leads to the castle, and this door leads to certain death.
Oh. How do you know? He could be telling the truth.
But then you wouldn't be. So if you told me that he said yes, I know the answer is no.
But I could be telling the truth.
But then he would be lying. So if you told me that he said yes, I know the answer would still be no.
Wait a minute. Is that right?
I don't know. I've never understood it.
No, it's right. I figured it out. Every time you raise your voice, I see the greener grass. Every time you run for cover, I see this pasture. Every time we're in a funk, I picture a different choice. Anytime we're in a rap, this distant grandeur. My Tennessee to want to do away feels natural, and my urgency to dream of softer places feels understandable. But
the only way out is through, the faster we're in the better. The only way out is through, Hotel Motley. The only way out is through, the only way we'll feel better. The only way out is through, Hotel Motley. I think there must be easier ways. Every time our horns are locked on towel throwing. Every time we're at a loss, we bolted from difficulty. Anytime we're in stalemate, a final bowing. My Tennessee to want to hide away feels easier, and the immediacy of picturing another place comforting to go. But the only way out is through, the faster we're in the better. The only way out is through, ultimately. The only way out is through, the only way we'll feel better. The only way out is through, struggle. I'm down for the count that day. Every time I dream of quick fix, I'm assuaged. Now I know it's hard when it's through, and I'm damned if I don't know quick fix way. But formerly was treatment silence, now outdated. My tendency to want to run feels unnatural now. The urgency to want to give to you